Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Evangelical Dark Web. My name is Ray. This is Anthony. We're Team Evangelical Dark Web. And tonight we're going to be discussing the recent interview between Tucker Carlson and John Rich. Now, Tucker Carlson, biggest name in Conservative Inc., even though he's independent these days, he's still the biggest name, one of the biggest podcasts. And that's kind of been mostly good. So you like to see that. And then John Rich is a country music star. He is best known for the song Save a Horse, Ride a Cowboy, which I'm not going to endorse the morals of that song particularly, but I do have to admit it is a banger. And there is a, I guess, an appropriate context in which a husband and wife can, you know, say the lyrics. So in a Song of Solomon sort of way. So with that said, he's apparently returned to his Christian roots since that song went huge, and he's come out recently with a song called Revelation, which is apparently a very commercially successful song, and he discusses that in his interview with Tucker Carlson, and he goes to town against pre-tribulational rapture, and I saw the comment that this doesn't necessarily go after dispensationalism, which is why it's in the headline of the video that it's about pre-trib rapture. And we're going to be discussing John Rich's take on pre-trib rapture tonight. That, you know, so Save a Horse, Revelation a Cowboy is kind of our motto for tonight's video. How are you doing, Anthony?
All is well.
All righty.
Get into it.
So this is going to be a quick live stream. It's going to be longer than a regular video, but shorter than our usual live stream is the goal for tonight. So with that said, this live stream brought to you by evangelicaldarkweb.org/join. That's our Patreon-like system that you can support Christian news, you know, and you get access to more content, bonus material behind the paywall. I had a good article on J.D. Vance that a lot of people wanted to read that was behind the paywall. The other two articles about him were not behind the paywall, but this one was apparently juicy enough that a lot of people wanted to read it. You could have read that if you were a Patreon-like system subscriber. Thank you to all those who are patrons of Evangelical Dark Web. We also have a free newsletter, and the least you can do is like this video, subscribe to the channel, to the podcast if you are new. Now, we have three clips that we are going to be discussing in tonight. This is the shortest of the clips, and if I can just find the timestamp. So here we go. And you're able to see screen.
After that, a guy named C.I. Schofield. Have you ever heard of a Schofield Bible?
Yes, I have.
Okay. So C.I. Schofield was basically a student of John Darby, and he adopted that part of the doctrine, and he incorporated that into the Bible. It was the first Bible ever made that had study notes with it. We have all kinds of Bibles now that have, you know, concordances and study notes.
So I'm going to pause right there, because what I also want to do is fact check him, because he makes a lot of claims that are not true, or that are, you know, a bit of a mistruth there. So this is one of those times in which he does kind of misspeak. The Schofield Bible is not the first Bible to contain a study note. To my knowledge, maybe Jerome had a commentary of the Vulgate. I'm not entirely sure, but I believe that the first Bible ever to have study notes printed with it was the 1599 Geneva Bible. That's at least the case in the English language. I don't know globally what that would be. The 1599 Geneva Bible was a Reformed theologian Bible, you know, in Geneva, and they had notes, study notes to go along with that Bible when it was printed. So that was the Bible that the American Revolution was founded on, by the way. So not the King James Bible for all you KJV only people out there. And I'm sure you're not going to like this live stream. Maybe you will if you like disagreement, but nonetheless, this is a bit of a misspeak by John Rich. So there's going to be some other factual errors that he makes.
I mean, it might be the most commercially successful
That is true.
Time, but it's not. I mean, yeah, and it's he does a couple misstatements, mistruths, like, and they're generally something along this line.
Right. So here we go. If I can.
And all kinds of stuff that go along. But this was the first one that was ever made. It became so popular. Every Christian was reading it. Every minister was reading it. And this continues today to this exact second. My own dad, when he went in seminary and was, you know, wanting to become a minister, they said, make sure you have a Scofield Bible now when you come to class. Have your Scofield Bible. Scofield Bible also adopted that entire John Darby philosophy of Christians will not be here when the bad stuff starts to happen. And most Christians still believe that. Matter of fact, a lot of my friends that are Christians are going to watch this interview are probably right now going, hang on a minute. Now, hang on. So this is pushing back against a doctrine that's been in existence now for coming up on 200 years. The problem with that doctrine is there's several places in the Bible where it talks about what's going to happen prior to Jesus Christ coming back to the earth. When he does come back, that is when what we call the rapture happens. The word rapture is nowhere in the Bible. It talks about us being caught up with him and pulled out of here, and then the ultimate wrath is poured out on this planet. That's what we call the rapture. So that's not in debate. The question is, what happens leading up to that? It's a good question to ask, right? For some reason, nobody ever preaches that. They don't want to talk about what all happens prior to it. So if I can I just read if we have time? That's why I love the thought of this interview.
I do too. But just to be clear, what you're saying is the Scofield Bible, its theology is deceptive.
I'm saying that the same way the media takes a factual situation and twists it and gives you a version of it, which we all know we're force-fed every single day, the same exact tactic was used in 1830 by John Darby. And guess who he was connected to, by the way? The Rothschilds.
Interesting.
Yeah, he was connected to the Rothschilds family back in the day. That he did the same exact tactic and twisted that. I don't know why he did that. It worked because it took off. And I mean, there were churches popping up everywhere right after that. I'm saying that, including me, including my own father, for a long time, that's what we believed too. But when you start actually going back and reading line by line by line what is said that will be leading up to Jesus coming back, which is when the rapture happens, it's the inverse of what John Darby put down.
So that is clip number one. Your reaction?
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting. I mean, obviously, he doesn't go enough into the history that obviously political Zionism did predate Christian Zionism and the whole and Darby in general. So that is an important note that obviously someone like a Rothschild might come around and say, hey, this guy has an idea that aligns with me. Therefore, I might give it a little push in the right direction to give it some momentum. I'm not entirely like well-versed on the details of Scofield and Rothschilds, but obviously I do know that the political aspect of Zionism did predate the Christian theology that largely buttresses it.
Okay. So I have done an insane amount of research on this very claim last night, and enough to delay the stream to today. And, you know, I was originally going to record it, but, you know, it'd be like that. So, yeah, I don't know the claim. So the claim that Rothschild infected Darby, I think, is inaccurate. I don't believe that they were. I'm not even sure that they were contemporaries. Political Zionism, or Zionism in general, was at its infancy around the time of Darby, as far as global ideas go. It was very infant. So it might have influenced Darby, but I don't believe the Rothschilds are a part of that. So I think that's a factual error. As far as, you know, major Zionist players go, I'm not sure where the Rothschilds fit into this. But there is Samuel Untermeyer, who was involved with the publishing of the Scofield reference Bible. I think that is a fairly plausible connection. Because let's look into the life and character of Cyrus Scofield. He was not a good dude. Like, it just point blank simple. He was not a good dude. He was a Confederate soldier who deserted. So, you know, not based at all for doing that, for being a deserter. And then we also got to talk about He had a political career because he was a lawyer, and apparently, and he was in, he was like a federal judge or prosecutor or something like that in the state of Kansas, and he got ousted pretty quickly for that. He served some time in jail, and while he was in jail, he was saved. And I'm putting that in quotes because I don't really think he lived a life that was indicative of him being a regenerate believer. So those are my thoughts on that part. So he's saved in jail because he was defrauding people, something like that. He, maybe it was creditors, but in any case, this guy was broke. He had no money. He is not funding the Scofield Bible out of his own pocket. He does not have the funds for that. He never gets the funds for that until after this Bible is published, if at all, if he even got, you know, super paid for that at all. But in the meantime, this is a guy who got divorced in the 1870s and 1880s. So 1879, his wife wants to separate from him because this dude does not provide for his family. He does not provide for his kids. And the divorce is finalized in 1883. So 1879 is when he becomes a believer. And then, you know, 4 years later, he's getting divorced and he still hasn't tried to reconcile with his wife. And there's no evidence that he tried to reconcile with his first wife. And then shortly after, he married his second wife. So this dude didn't provide for his wife and kids. And there's documentation of the time at the time, and the judge just kind of rips into him, and he's basically denied custody and may not even have the rights to even see his child. My reading on how custody worked in, you know, 18th or 19th century divorce proceedings, little rusty because it's not as spelled out as it would be today, but it doesn't even look like he was allowed to see his kids. That's how bad of a father he was to his two daughters from his first marriage. So this guy was not above reproach, and he was not the husband of one wife. He didn't exactly try to reconcile his marriage after becoming supposedly saved. And this is the guy that so many people look up to. This is the guy that generations of good faith believers, I would say they're still good faith, they looked up to this guy who had no business being a pastor.
It's like you see the name on the label and you don't quite understand who was the name behind the label.
Something else is, I believe he also called himself a doctor. You know, he had like a doctorate degree when he never did. And I believe that that's also published in the Scofield Bible. It gives him the title doctorate, a doctorate title, which he did not earn. So a lot of interesting stuff that I've learned over the years regarding Scofield and the other stuff. So Pastor Michael Grant says, Darby was not the first pre-tribber. Yeah, I don't know quite about that. I know he's not the first premillennialist. I mean, Darby's famous for the introduction of dispensationalism into the church, which we'll try to talk about how separate that is from the issue of pre-tribulation rapture. We'll try to see how separate those two issues really are. I'm not really convinced. I mean, they can be separate.
The clip in particular was mainly about, you know, all these people are, you know, being taught by their churches to don't worry about the worst things that could possibly come. You won't be here, so you don't have to worry about, you know, Antichrist and, you know, the worst of the tribulation and the worst of the apostasy. You don't have to worry about that because you'll be in heaven. So that is kind of what Rich is early on going against.
And yeah, I mean, John Rich definitely is trying to, you know, I like what he's doing, like off the interview. It's like I've looked into him. He's really being a contributing force in the parallel economy. So he's definitely taken the opposite approach of we can just sit back and you know, wait upon rapture to get rescued. And that's largely what he's focusing on. It's largely the message. He doesn't really get into dispensationalism, but I'm really unconvinced that pre-tribulational rapture can even exist without dispensationalism, or as in terms of mainstream theology. I don't even know how it makes sense that there's going to be a period of time where there's no church on earth, and then Jesus has not returned yet. He had a secret return, but hasn't come in full. I don't know how you really do that. So this is the next portion. It's a lot longer than the last portion was.
Oh, that's a big deal.
That's crazy. That's absolutely crazy. So
a lot of Christians watching this right now are very upset with me.
Why?
Because I'm saying something that's pushing back against something they have grown up believing. I grew up believing it too. So did my dad. And since 1830, people have believed this, that you're going to be out of here before any of the bad stuff happens. It just doesn't say that.
So I wanted to pause right here. Is I don't know if I was ever convinced by pre-trib. Post-trib, I found to be a lot more convincing, even when I was probably a lot more dispensational in my eschatology. I never really found pre-trib to be all that convincing.
I mean, I think a lot of probably been like so immersed in certain eschatological traditions, mostly being pre-trib, just because those. A lot of people that grew up in like these Baptist churches, like that's what they're taught. But I don't think it became commonplace until after World War II. And I think a lot of the Presbys and a lot of these mainline denominations, which might have been more Amill, probably fell away due to Darwinism. If we're just going to put like what made those theologies fall in America, it's probably the fact that all of them went Darwinist and denied inerrancy. But the pre-trib guys didn't.
So Philip asks, is John Rich a Calvinist? I did not gather that he was a Calvinist. He does seem to believe in lordship salvation from this interview. So, and he does articulate that position. We're not going to cover the entire interview and everything he says about Christianity. We're going to cover three different segments. But he does give a very good talk on repentance. And I'm not sure if that's in the section that we're covering, but
also, it's this is eminent.
Pretty good.
So, if you can give me enough time to read.
Oh my gosh, right, please. Here. I'm okay. Fascinated.
This is 2 Thessalonians 2, which doesn't get preached very much. This is Paul wrote this. Now, brethren, concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and our gathering together to him, meaning his second coming, we ask you not to be soon shaken in mind or troubled, either by spirit or by word or by letter, as is from us, as though the day of Christ had come. Let no one deceive you by any means, for that day, the day he comes back, will not come unless the falling away comes first and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition, who is who we refer to as the Antichrist, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshiped, so that he sits as God in the temple or in the place of God, showing himself that he is God. Jesus hadn't come back yet. This is happening. Do you not remember when I was still with you? I told you these things. And now you know what is restraining that he may be revealed in his own time. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who now restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way, meaning it's being held back. And then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. Talking about the second coming. The coming of the lawless one is according to the work of Satan, with all power, signs, and lying wonders, and with all unrighteous deception among those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved. Meaning it was rejected. They were told the truth and they rejected it. And for this reason, God will send them a strong delusion that they should believe the lie, that they all may be condemned who did not believe the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. Let's stop right there. You're telling me God is going to send a delusion on people? He's going to do that? He's going to be the one to make them go into chaos and not understand, he says, yes, that is what he's going to do, because he's given them chance after chance after chance, and they refused to believe the truth and rather believed a lie when the Antichrist shows up.
Lowe's knows you've got a job to do, and we help get it done. With the MyLowe's Pro Rewards program, eligible members save more with volume discounts on qualifying orders through a quote of $2,000 or more. Join for free today. Lowe's, we help you save. Offer can't be combined with any other discount, contract, and or special pricing. Exclusions, more terms, and restrictions apply. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
But we are bound to give thanks to God always for you, brethren, beloved by the Lord, because God from the beginning chose you for salvation through sanctification by the Spirit and belief in the truth, to which he called you by our gospel for the obtaining of glory of our Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore, brethren, stand fast and hold the traditions which you were taught, whether by word or by epistle, meaning by letter. Now may our Lord Jesus Christ himself and our God and Father, who has loved us and given us everlasting consolation and good hope by grace, comfort your hearts and establish you in every good word and work. So that's 2 Thessalonians 2. He lays out, before he comes back, you're going to see the Antichrist. He's going to show up. He's going to be running the place. Now that goes, I'm telling you right now, heads are exploding in the church world and with a lot of Christians. They're going, but you can get mad all you want to. I'm reading it verbatim. If you don't, if you got a problem with that, go tell him you got a problem with it. If you don't want to believe it, put some lighter fluid on your Bible and throw it in the fireplace, because what's the point? It says what it says.
So I'm personally in a weird position where I've never heard any of these conversations. Okay.
Your thoughts on the 2 Thessalonians 2
commentary? I mean, I was reading... Again, I was reading. I told you before the show. I was reading these old commentaries, and I'll just try to summarize it briefly. Matthew Henry and John Calvin's on this exact passage, and they made a pretty convincing case that the Pope is Antichrist, which is funny because that doesn't necessarily contradict a pre-trib rapture idea, but that's just something I've read into, and it's a fascinating case that when the verse says that the power is being restrained, that's referring to the Roman Empire restraining the church, or the Pope is in this case. And if you watch like Spencer Smith, who does the Third Adam series, he talks about how all the false churches will align under the Roman banner, which basically is, you know, the Antichrist, the kingdom of Antichrist. And that's actually happening right now when you look at things like Hillsong, Francis Chan. So a lot of these hyper-charismatic sects are out there, and even Orthobros and Anglicans are kind of realigning under or with Rome. So there are a lot of interesting developments that, you know, the Westminster Confession calling the Pope Antichrist. Well, you know, that we might be coming back to an era where that's a lot more palatable and feasible. Even, and the Pope claiming to be vicar of Christ is, you know, exalting oneself above God. That's where that commentary comes in.
So one thing that's clear in my reading of 2 Thessalonians 2 is that the apostasy comes before the Antichrist, or man of lawlessness, the Antichrist. Because he makes a claim that the Bible doesn't say Antichrist, which I'm pretty sure is not true. The Bible doesn't talk about a singular antichrist. It talks about many antichrists, but Paul is talking about a man of lawlessness. And that is what we call the antichrist. And the man of lawlessness comes after the apostasy and a great falling away. But it does seem to be a specific person or being. So that's one thing that I found interesting. It definitely leaves a lot of the Jewish question out of it. I don't know how you can get there in
Thessalonians 2 unless you go full preterist. All that stuff.
Right, unless you're talking about a more full preterist view where someone did rise up to be an antichrist and they were the abomination of desolation, which is, we're going to talk about Matthew 24, I believe, in the next clip. But to me, like, that's maybe plausible. I'm not as read up on how the Jews revolted against Rome and were subsequently put down in AD 70.
I'm not sure whether the revolt started
a little bit before that. But to me, the revolt was the abomination of desolation. And then that being put down was the judgment of God. I think that's my read on it, because they revolted against Rome. They were basically trying to be their own Messiah.
And just on the passage real quick, I think it was Calvin's commentary that when he's talking about the great apostasy, he's saying that God, that it makes sense that for the kingdom of Antichrist, that is the reason God allowed the church to become so perverse over the course of time, is that this was the Antichrist. So when he's talking about Rome doing all its shenanigans, and again, this is the 1500s, that is the kingdom of Antichrist coming into its ascendancy. So that is interesting that, you know, this is what a lot of, I guess, Reformed and Presbys thought at one point. Here we are, almost coming full circle.
Here we are. So it's interesting. I don't think 2 Thessalonians 2 is about AD 70, in my opinion. I don't see enough hints about that. I do think that Matthew 24 heavily talks about AD 70, but also talks about the future, because Jesus has a tendency to do that.
Prophecies and scripture in general.
Which I'll get to in a moment, because we're going to talk about that, I believe, in the next segment. This segment's almost over, so here we go.
I didn't grow up in a church like that at all. I grew up in a fake church. And
Episcopalian.
That makes total sense to me that there would be deception. Well, there is deception everywhere, but you're saying that...
Well, it's saying...
That this letter, Paul's letter to the Thessalonians, yeah, says, and Revelation says, and maybe Daniel says too, it's all over the Bible, that there will be a leader who people worship as God who is not God.
Yeah, I'll read this piece one more time. Let no one deceive you by any means, for that day will not come unless the falling away comes first and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition.
Which means lying.
The son of perdition is who we would refer to as the Antichrist. The word Antichrist doesn't exist in the Bible either. Neither does rapture. That's just when we read this throughout history.
Really? The word Antichrist is not in there?
No. Rapture's from Vulgate. Huh. The Vulgate.
No, or rapture.
Huh.
It's the words we use to describe what they're laying out. So how dangerous is that if Christians believe I'll be gone before this ever happens? So when they are still here and he does show up, they're going to be walking right into a buzzsaw.
So that, I mean, but it like raises the question that I wrestle.
So that was clip number two. So you're talking about rapture like comes from the Vulgate and not rapio, the Latin. Greek. Ironic. I think it's very ironic because several bad criticisms of Catholicism have led to much of the Anabaptist dispensationalist camp. Like, a lot of them have very bad critiques of the papacy. And that, to me, contributes to their theology. So I just think it's ironic that rapture is, you know, taken from the Latin Vulgate. So another thing to note is, what do you think of Tucker Carlson and his, like, you think he's a seeker of truth in this instance, that he's genuinely curious, or do you think there's more of an agenda at work here? What do you think of his style of interviewing?
I think he's trying to turn over some stones, and obviously foreign policy being very against interventionist thought is something he is very much for. And in the interview, I don't know if it's in any of the clips, he does talk about how this theology, and that is heavily implying dispensational premillennialism, has influenced foreign policy. So that is part of his angle, is he is trying to confront this theology because of its impact on American foreign policy, and dare I say, horrible impact on its theology. Or on its foreign policy.
Yes, and he does say something to that.
So I would say
he does
say something to that effect.
I believe it's in the next clip. Man of Lawlessness, Antichrist, and the Beast are all assumed to be the same person. I agree with that. I just noted that the person, that the word Antichrist in the Bible does not refer to the Antichrist or Man of Lawlessness or the Beast. I believe it's John who uses it in one of his epistles that uses the term Antichrist, but it basically just meant people who are, you know, against God, essentially, which I believe the next section is about the mark of the beast. So let's get to that.
But is that true? So even now people believe that?
100%.
Most. Well, maybe that's a good example of the principle that you're describing, or the fact that you're describing.
Yeah.
That Christians who are, you know, trying their best, yeah, are still going to fall for things that are lies.
Because they have, yes, because not just them, and this is not the preacher's fault. Mm-hmm. This is not the Christian's fault. They're not at fault for this. This has been around since way, way, way before any of us were ever thought about. It's become accepted doctrine that the footnotes and that Scofield adopted from Darby is biblically accurate. And the only way those can be biblically accurate is you're going to have to erase several of the things that were said in there, like the one I just read in 2 Thessalonians 2. You'd have to rip those pages out for that to make sense, because it literally lays out step by step, this, you're going to see this, and then I'm going to show up. The greatest one ever is Matthew 24, and that does get preached a lot, but they preach it backwards, and I don't know.
So I just want to say I love the compassion that he's demonstrating to people who believe in pre-tribulation rapture. He just thinks that, you know, these are good people that have been and steeped in a bad tradition. And that's basically also kind of my view as well.
Keep in mind, I don't think churches.
And he's very sympathetic because he came from that background as well.
Growing up, there's only like three different types of eschatologies. He never probably. No, it would just be amill, post-mill, and then, you know, just be pre-mill. Maybe there's some discrepancy on the trip.
But the amill would be taught as full.
Yeah, I mean, it would just basically be talking.
That's how I first learned what amillennial
theology. They don't take the Bible literally. That's kind of how amill would be taught.
That is a huge myth. Right. And it's a huge myth that dispensationalism is about taking the Bible literally, because I've had people who are dispensationalists say the same thing. It's all about which sections you believe are literal versus which ones you don't, which ones you take as not being literal. So that's a straw man on either side, but, you know, most of it, again, this, you know, eschatology, not the easiest thing in the world, but still, I appreciate that John Rich is very compassionate to the other side. So let's get into Matthew 24.
I don't know how much scripture you'll let me read on the show.
I'm really interested. Okay. By the way, anyone who's not interested in this stuff will have fallen away by now.
Sure.
So. He's right about that.
But I think, again, at least in the weird world that I'm from, more people are interested in this than have ever been.
I think so. I think it does talk about a great revival happening at some point. You know, that's when I go back to a near-death experience will get your attention faster than anything.
It happened to me. I know.
Yeah. I've had a couple myself.
Yep.
All right. Matthew 24. You ready?
Yeah.
Now, this is Jesus talking to the disciples, and they're hanging out in a park, basically in a nice little spot that they were hanging out. Matthew 24, start with verse 3. Now, as he sat on the Mount of Olives, talking about Jesus, the disciples came to him privately saying, "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age?" Asking him. And Jesus answered and said to them, "Take heed that no one deceives you. For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and will deceive many. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled. For all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake." Now, that's an important part right there, because a lot of people have taught over the years that because he was talking to the 12 disciples, that he was specifically only referring to them and their country and their heritage. But when it says for bearing my name, for my name's sake, that means Chinese Christians, North Korean Christians, Eskimo Christians, South American Christians, American Christians, anybody in this period of time that bears the name of Jesus Christ will be hunted. It says killed, hunted, hated by all the nations around the earth. That's an important distinction.
So I just want to say, just a point about Matthew 24, and I believe it's also in Matthew 10. It's when Jesus is giving the dialogue on discipleship. So when he says, brother will turn against brother and mother against son and father against son and stuff like that. When he says that, you know, that's part of the discourse where Jesus talks to the disciples immediately about what's happening to them, what they're going to face. Then he talks beyond them into the future. And then he talks back to the disciples again. And Jesus did that in Matthew 10. I think it's Matthew 10. The one about the disciples, the discipleship dialogue. Maybe it's Matthew 12. But somewhere around there. And he also does it in Matthew 24, in my opinion. And you saw the shift when it talks about all the nations and stuff like that. So, you know, this is just the beginning.
And you also,
there's a time.
I'm not sure how many people focusing. Interpret so, that verse not to apply to the broader church as a whole.
That seems pretty widely agreed upon, but John Rich is making an argument against preterism here. So I just thought that was pretty interesting. There's some talk about that, because if I had to guess, John Rich is a post-tribulation premillennialist.
Yeah, I had to guess.
Somewhere around that. Or maybe he's a post-tribulation amillennialist. Because I don't know what his belief on the millennia is, which is Revelation 20, I believe. That's not a reference chapter.
And then many will be offended. That sounds familiar. Will betray one another and will hate one another. Then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. But he who endures to the end shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all nations. And then the end will come. Now here we go here. Therefore.
So this is, in my interpretation, Jesus is now going back to the past. I believe he's trying to go back. He's going back to the, you know, the disciples. So he just made it to the end right there, in my opinion.
When you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, the abomination of desolation, Tucker, is when the Antichrist steps into that role.
I would disagree with that, to be honest.
We talked about in 2 Thessalonians. When you see him standing in the holy place, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let he who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of the house. And let him who is in the field not go back to even get his clothes. And woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days. And pray that your flight may not be in winter or on the Sabbath. For then will be the great tribulation, such as not been seen since the beginning of the world unto this time, no, nor ever shall be. Jesus still hadn't come back yet. Remember, this is the disciples asking him, what's going to happen before you come back? All these things are happening. And unless those days be shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, meaning his people, those days will be shortened. Then if anyone says to you, look, here's the Christ, or there, do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, meaning they'll perform miracles in front of you. If possible, they could even deceive the elect. See that I've told you beforehand. Therefore, if they say to you, look, he's in the desert, do not go there. Or look, he's in the inner rooms, do not believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man. For wherever the carcass is, there the eagles will be gathered together. Now we're in verse 29. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven and the powers of heavens will be shaken. Then, verse 30, then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven. And then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And then he will send his angels with a great cloud and a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. Matthew 24, when the disciples asked him, what's going to be happening before you come back, boss? All right, sit down, I'm going to tell you. And he goes play by play, and then this, and then that, and then this, and this, and this. And after this happens, then you'll see me coming.
So he takes a very linear approach to this verse. I kind of see it as, you know, he's talking about the present or the near future, I should say. Because this is what? This is AD 27 when Jesus is saying this, because that's probably when Jesus was crucified. It was AD 27 or AD 30. AD 30, because if we say that Jesus was born around, you know, 5 or 6 to 380, would probably, or BC, sorry, 6 to 3 BC is probably when Jesus was born. Or maybe is it 5 to 3, or 5 to something, 5 to 2, depending on the zero year. But in any case, this is talking about the near future, then it's talking about the distant future, then it's talking about the near future, and then it sounds like it's talking about the distant future again. So Jesus does these kind of jumps, in my opinion. And it's not the first time, it's not the only time in Matthew he does this. Because Matthew is not the most chronological book in the Bible. It's actually not super chronological. I believe the disciples are recruited, like it has the disciples being recruited well after the disciples are recruited, but it, you know, it focuses on different things at different times. So that's my read on the situation. Your take?
I mean, obviously when it talks about the sun and moon start falling, sun, moon and stars falling, that's kind of like the creation language that you see throughout some of the Old Testament. And that is basically used to pronounce judgment upon a city. And in this case, it would be Jerusalem would be that city. The nation's mourning, I mean, that could be interpreted contemporary with the nations encompassed under Rome. Obviously, I like at the end where then it goes out, then it spreads out into the four winds. That could be a reference to actually the church spreading out into the four winds of heaven, that, you know, the Great Commission will take off. And I forget where in the Bible it is where it's talking about the age of the Gentile coming after the age of the Jew. And that's a reference to the fall of Jerusalem. Well, that would, and Jerusalem falling would be the mark of the age of the Gentile beginning. But when Jesus talked about the Son of Man coming from the clouds of heaven and being in glory, that is a claim of divinity, because that is God's the Father's role to pronounce judgment. So him taking up that kind of imagery is a claim of divinity.
Right. So flee to the hills means you're going to escape the literal star falling to the earth. Exactly. You know, it's talking about Judea specifically because of the revolt, which I think was an evil act. It was evil for the Jews to revolt against Rome. And, you know, a lot of talk about the lesser of two evils these days. Yeah, God sided with God used the lesser of two evils to punish the people that rejected him in AD 70. So, some people didn't like when I, in the abolitionist camp, which I'm still an abolitionist. Some people didn't like that when I was saying that, but I was just trying to be, trying to be something of an edgelord myself. All right, we'll finish this section.
So it is such a dangerous mindset for really saved people and Christians to think that they're going to be pulled out of here before any of this happens. Why is that dangerous? Because when those things happen, you're going to think it's not the real deal. You're going to think, well, I'm still here, so that can't be it. It must be something else. And the decisions you make under that false pretense would be catastrophic to you. It says anybody that takes the mark of the beast, that their name is not written in the Lamb's book of life. Meaning the names that are written down, the ones that are going to heaven, your name is not written in the Lamb's book of life if you take that. I mean, this is no joke.
How do you not take it?
How do you not take the mark?
Yeah.
You have to be willing to die, suffer. I think about there's Christians right now all over the world being killed by the hundreds of thousands. We just don't talk about it. They're killing them in China. They're killing them in North Korea. They're killing them in Africa. They're killing them in the Middle East. why are we above those people? You think America gets to dodge this at some point? Absolutely not. It's a perilous thing to bear the name of Jesus Christ in this world.
One of the reasons I went. So,
that is the end of the third clip that I wanted to show. Your thoughts on his interpretation of the mark of the beast?
I mean, I don't necessarily have perspective on what right it is. Now, I just haven't been in that area of study. But in general, he will take a more technocratic view of the mark of the beast, and that's probably after this part of the interview or after this exact clip. But he does take the technocratic, you know, chip implant, which is probably where you would arrive that he's some kind of post-trib, regardless of what he actually believes about the millennium. But yeah, I don't necessarily have an interpretation on mark of the beast other than it could refer to like Domitian under Rome, where there was actually a cult, the cult of the emperor, which was also a sign of incredible weakness on behalf of the Roman emperor, which is why they had to press the whole Roman cult super hard. And obviously we've seen this with the vaccine passports, that they wanted to roll out some form of mark of the beast, even if it's not the official mark of the beast.
Okay. What is the exact verse on Mark of the Beast? I know 666 is Revelation 13.
Top of my head, I don't know.
And you know, my interesting thing about the Mark of the Beast or whatever is the you hold up a dollar and you'll see on the U.S. seal there's a six pointed star made out of several stars, which is kind of Masonic, but you know. My thoughts on the Star of Rephrim being the Mark of the Beast, because no other symbol, to me, encapsulates 666 quite as well. I'm trying to remember what the actual verse on the Mark of the Beast is. But my opinion is, hand or forehead, sorry, it's verse 16 in Revelation 13. And he causes all, the small and the great and the rich and the poor, and the free man and the slaves, to be given a mark on their right hand or on their forehead. So my view of the mark of the beast is that it is something that all reprobate have. All reprobate have taken the mark of the beast. It is actually impossible for a believer to do so, in my opinion. It's also impossible for the believer to actually be deceived. I believe that was Matthew 24. Like, to deceive even the elect, there is a strong implication that the elect cannot actually be deceived. And my point about the whole mark of the beast, being able to buy or trade goods with
the U.S. dollar is
that the U.S. dollar has the Masonic 666 symbol on it. And that we cannot buy or trade without the U.S. dollar.
Well, not anymore. So.
Well, you technically can more so these days, but symbolically, because of all things measured in dollars, that would be more accurate. But in my view on the whole mark of the beast on the right hand or forehead is more spiritual. It, you know, the people who are God's elect are marked. They got the helmet of salvation. They can be identified. On the other side of that, the beast, he can identify his followers by their mark on their forehead.
I mean, obviously, you can go back to Genesis 4 with the mark of Cain. People associate that with the mark on the forehead. But also, I know in Leviticus, when they talk about like having the leprosy on your body, if it was on your head, that was considered like, you know, complete. You were no longer unclean. So, and it's because the head, what the head symbolizes. So I do think there is some symbolism in terms of the head or the forehead and the hands. I'm not quite sure on what the hands represent aside from like labor.
So this is to me, because I don't know if he read the next verse. Maybe I'm wrong and that he does continue to read the next verse, but I think they kind of get sidetracked. But to me, Matthew 24 just decimates the idea of a pre-trib rapture. I want to read verses 36 through 41. But of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven nor the Son, but the Father alone. For the coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark. And they did not understand until the flood came and took them all away. Global flood. Yeah, of course. So will be the coming of the Son of Man. Then there will be two men in a field. One of them will be taken, one, and one will be left. Two women will be grinding at the mill. One will be taken, one will be left. Who is getting taken in these situations? The baddie. The baddie is getting taken. The reprobate is getting taken. The elect is staying on the earth. It's interesting that Christ says that, just like in the days of Noah, and then says the reprobate, the people that were being killed in the flood, they were taken. Noah was not taken up from them. They were taken from Noah. The flood took away the reprobates. And exactly, this is the line of thinking that we need to kind of have to understand these texts. The baddies are getting taken away. This is not the only parable in which Jesus makes this point, but Matthew 24, it being pretty relevant to the occasion. Yes, I am using the NAS of 1995. So all the verses about rapture that even seem to indicate a rapture indicates that the baddies are being taken away. So it's kind of interesting that this is one of those verses that people think references the rapture, but they get it backwards. So if there is a rapture, it happens immediately with Jesus coming. But Jesus teaches that the meek will inherit the earth, and therefore who's actually the ones getting whisked away? So those are my thoughts on pre-trib rapture. And I don't believe John Rich makes this point, which I thought was a much stronger argument against pre-trib than a lot of the mentality stuff that he was saying. But it's like right there, if you just keep reading, right there, if you just, kept on reading Matthew 24.
No.
You have any comments on that?
Haven't quite studied that passage lately.
I am going to be in the Old Testament for a long time because I've finished reading Revelation. I've done my cover to cover, so I'm in Genesis right now. So it's going to be a long time before I get to the end again. But I wrote a lot of notes in Revelation. I wrote a lot of notes, more notes than I wrote for any other. But I've started taking more and more notes because maybe I'll develop a Bible commentary one day. I'm just kidding. But if I do, I'll have a basis of notes to work with. Or to launch from. The question I have to ask is, how should eschatology influence the way that Christians should live? And ultimately, what John Rich is getting at is that that the people that believe in a pre-tribulational rapture are essentially being lazy in the faith in some instances. That in some cases, it's working out great for evangelism, because he does say that. He does say a lot of people are getting saved during the rise of this theology. So he does say that. But then he says, he kind of articulates a complacency that this theology created. So how should eschatology influence the way that Christians should live? It should give us more active missional sense. It should give us, in some ways, a long game. Like a lot of people kind of use eschatology, the imminency of Christ's return, as an excuse not to be making strides. But Jesus talked about the people who are laboring when the master returns, and that you want to be the person, you want to be the person who has enough oil in their lamp, that's actually using
the talents to gain wealth and gain a return.
Exactly.
That's active. Well, yeah. Right. But
not just wealth.
Parable to talent.
How are you stewarding what God has given you? You should be trying to grow whatever God has given you, in my opinion. So, and Jesus says, those who do nothing with what I've given them, take what they have and give it to the person who does something with what God has given them. So that to me is how Christians should live, how eschatology should influence Christians, but it's hard, in my opinion, for pre-trib rapture to do that. I can understand how post-millennials do that. I can understand how amillennials do that. Historic pre-mill, a little more difficult. But, and then we can talk about dispensationalism, which is kind of where I want to end. How separable do you think pre-trib and dispensationalism are?
I mean, they probably have some separation, but I mean, historically, they just don't. Like, I obviously, you can have some kind of partial rapture. Maybe you could do a mid or post-trib rapture, but obviously, dispensationalism, I don't think it's...
For the sake of argument, mid-trib is still pre-trib. For the sake of this question, because post-trib would be at Christ's return. So, those who are elect are called up to Christ and help welcome him down, which I think is biblically plausible. There are parables that kind of suggest that. But you're saying it's kind of historically inseparable
from some form of premillennialism.
See, it's what happens in between the pre and the pre-trib and the second or now the third return of Christ that kind of relies on dispensational theology. In dispensational theology, they teach that two witnesses, Elijah and Enoch, I want to say, are the two witnesses, will return. They will preach the gospel to the ethnic Jews. There will be a small revival because it lists 144,000. That's what they think the 144,000 refers to. And the armies will come against them. And these witnesses will be martyred, I believe, is also what they believe. But this all happens in between the rapture and Christ's third return.
Yeah, I think that's, 3.5 years or something? Or
I don't even know which part of the 3.5 year, which part of the 7 years or whatever this is supposed to be. What is this all like? All this stuff about the two witnesses is happening in the first 3 years of that, and then there's somewhat of a false peace in the and at the midpoint. It's very difficult to line it up, and obviously there's a lot of stuff in the dispensationalist camp that they keep debating because these minute details about these finite details about the order of events is so it is.
I mean, it's a very rigid system, and obviously when you have that many different variables, it's kind of like the straw that breaks the camel's back. That if one thing is completely off, then that means the entire equation is off.
Right. So, anyway, that was a deep dive into the post-trib debate, I guess, using Tucker Carlson and John Rich as a backdrop. Is the original language years or period of time?
I'm not.
The Daniel countdown was during the time of Christ was when that was supposed to.
I mean, that uses heptas, which is sevens.
So, my read on the millennium is that it's the day of judgment, but it lasts like the day of judgment for the elect. But God is so thorough in handing out, you know, you get to help rule with Christ and stuff like that, that it lasts like 1,000 years. That's how long the day of judgment for the elect takes, is my read on Revelation 20. And then the devil is loosed to deceive the world, but it doesn't say that he succeeds. And then he's quickly judged. Like the judgment of the elect takes a long time. The judgment of Satan and the damned is very brief. That's kind of my read of Revelation 20. So that's all I got to say about that for now. My name is Ray, this is the Evangelical Dark Web. Wanted to keep this a short stream. Have a blessed night. Stay based. Christ is King, and we will.